It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll learn about highly successful restoration efforts for the trumpeter swans in our state.
First, documents obtained by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel show that the state's Public Records Board characterized the public record changes it made last summer as significant, even though the board told the public and news organizations that the changes, subsequently canceled, were not substantive.
Mary Spicuzza reported on the story, and she joins us now. She's a reporter who covers politics and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Mary, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, what new information do we have about these proposed changes from the State Records Board last summer?
So it was interesting because when we first reported on these changes, there was a lot of pushback from state officials who said these are not significant changes. These were routine clarifications, just expanding an existing rule that dealt with transitory records or what records could be deleted or destroyed immediately. So what was interesting is we got, you know, hundreds of pages of documents, but one of the first ones I opened was an email from Georgia Thompson, who works for the board, alerting state records officers to what she called significant changes. So that just seemed contradictory to the message that had been going out to the public from folks on the board.
Would you consider that a reframing, then, of the way we had understood it, as, at least as far as journalists and the public had been given given information about that subject?
It seemed to really kind of reinforce the idea that these were indeed significant, sweeping or serious changes to what records could be deleted. And, you know, one argument that some of the records board officials made is that, you know, they made this change that was routine and then state officials maybe expanded on what they considered to be transitory and kind of went above and beyond what the board's plans were. But I think her email would indicate to somebody that, you know, at least she and some other folks on the board or state officials saw these to be significant changes and significant enough that they would kind of blast them out to state officials to let them know and to tell them that significant changes had been made. So it did seem to kind of reinforce the public's understanding that this was a pretty sweeping change.
And based on what you've read from this search of documents that you just got, what do we know about how long the deliberation process went and what that was like?
So in the emails and other documents that we got, we saw discussion dating back to early last year. So the decision was made in August, which has since been revoked, but the expansion of records that could be destroyed was made in August. And it looked like for weeks, if actually not months, that they had been looking at expanding this definition and that there was quite a bit of back and forth from state officials trying to decide how to define transitory records. And it seemed like they kind of, I don't want to say they struggled with the definition, but they certainly deliberated on how to expand it and seemed to, some of them raised concerns about the definition being too vague. So it did seem like there was at least an understanding that this is something that needed to be approached carefully and thoughtfully.
You see this as a disconnect between what the public was told about the significance of the changes and what the employees were told internally. Did you see any sort of deliberation about why there may have been that disconnect?
I didn't in these emails, you know, and we did read through hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents, but I really didn't see anything. I didn't see any indication that somebody was saying, hey, let's tell state officials this and public officials or you know, public this, state officials this, or any kind of, you know, direct planning on that, but it certainly did seem to be a disconnect. And, you know, from what I was told, even as we were writing our stories several months ago, there seemed to be a lot of criticism that we were kind of ginning up the changes to be more significant and more sweeping than they really were.
We're talking with Mary Spicuzza from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel right now. She's joining us to talk about the latest on State Records Board changes, which were proposed last summer and since canceled. And Mary, can you put this into a wider context for us? This subject of transparency in government and open records has been a very active one in Wisconsin. How do you put this in the context of what's happened in the last year or so?
Yeah, it was interesting to see. So there were about 1,900 citizens who wrote emails about these transitory records changes, which was pretty incredible that, you know, so many people would take the time to write about something that can be a little confusing, honestly, even to people covering it, of what transitory means, what records can be destroyed. And I think part of the reason that we saw such a public outcry was that this came on the heels of, you know, the Independence Day holiday last year during the budget, where leaders in the legislature on joint finance really made a last-minute change to the budget that would have, if it had been successful, would have really cut back on what public records people could get and how they could monitor what the government is doing. Those were sweeping limits on open records that, again, came under really withering criticism, and officials quickly backtracked. I think those were probably some of the most miserable 4th of July parades that some of those folks ever had, because they were really hearing from members of the public. So, you know, that was just last summer. Then this was in August. We had seen some of my colleagues at the Journal Sentinel reported just a few months ago about how the Department of Natural Resources had kept a do not respond list for citizens and activists who would write to the agency, where they were kind of blacklisted. And so I think that there have just been a series of concerns about government transparency and how citizens and members of the media can monitor and see how government is working and how decisions are being made. And I'm thinking that that's maybe why we saw some of the public outcry we did on transitory records.
There were those two twin outcries over access to public records last year, as you just outlined there. Where would you say that conversation is now in the state? I know the governor has weighed in on some procedural changes. Attorney General Brad Schimmel has had things to say about this. What is the new atmosphere about open records and transparency?
Well, the Attorney General has called for some stronger guidance about what records should be retained. He's urged officials to err on the side of openness and called for updates to the open records law to address some of these changes in technology. He's drawn criticism in the past for not releasing training videos. So he's, you know, had some criticism but has called for greater transparency. Walker also has drawn criticism for not releasing things that he said were kind of deliberative process records that he didn't want to release and that members of the public and media have been wanting and asking for. However, the governor did just do that executive order last month as part of Sunshine Week, calling for state agencies to handle public records requests more promptly, to better track them and kind of give more consistent guidelines on what people can expect in terms of costs and weights and things like that. So I think that at least we're hearing from the governor and state leaders that there are efforts to become more transparent, and we'll just have to see how those play out as we file more records requests probably.
And I know that technology has been a continuing part of this discussion as well, and how to handle things like text messages and email. Do we know anything about how those might be framed and handled going forward?
Yeah, it seems like every time you look, there's a new way. There's GChat or instant messaging or even apps that kind of like self-destruct messages. And it does kind of raise questions about what are we not getting. And I think that's part of the problem that some of the advocates that we've talked to have raised, is they raise concerns about how will we know what we're not getting, how will we know what's being destroyed. And so I do think that state officials and the Attorney General's office have said at least that they've discouraged public officials and state officials from using texts and kind of transitory things that could be transitory to do government business, or if they do, to somehow, you know, create a record by emailing them to themselves. But it does, I think all this new technology does raise questions about how state officials might be communicating that you couldn't track the way you could, you know, just get an email or a document as part of a routine public records search.
And Mary, just briefly as we wrap up here, have you heard from the State Records Board about your story and how they responded to it?
You know, we haven't yet, although my colleague Patrick Marley was heading to a meeting today, this afternoon, so I think that he probably would be the best person to ask, and I'm eagerly awaiting him give me a call to let me know how that goes.
Great. Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Mary Spacuzza, reporter who covers politics and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she joined us there with the latest on state records board changes proposed last summer and since canceled. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about states like Mississippi and North Carolina that are facing boycotts for passing what they describe as religious liberty laws. A lot of critics say they actually discriminate against the LGBT community.
First, trumpeter swans like those that we just heard were once abundant in much of North America, including Wisconsin, but during the 19th century, overhunting and other factors greatly reduced their populations, eventually landing them on the endangered species list.
In the 1980s, biologists in Wisconsin started reintroducing the species to the wild. For the past several decades, these recovery efforts have become a big success.
Here to talk more about this comeback story is Sumner Madison, avian biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Sumner, welcome to Central Time.
Pleasure to be with you.
Well, how would you say trumpeter swans are doing in Wisconsin today?
They are doing incredibly well. We have a population of 4,695 as of the last survey in 2015.
And it hasn't always been this way. This has been a long road to recovery. What sort of situation was this swan population in, if you go back, a century or so?
Sure. They were once fairly common throughout most of the northern United States and Canada, but market hunting and the millinery trade rapidly depleted breeding populations during the 19th century. Thousands of swan skins, mostly from trumpeters, were sent to Europe, where they were used to make ladies' powder puffs, while the feathers were used to adorn fashionable women's hats. So by the late 1800s, it was widely believed that the species had become extinct. But fortunately, a small non-migratory population survived in the remote mountain valleys of Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming. And in 1932, 69 trumpeter swans were documented in that region, and in 1935, the Fish and Wildlife Service established Red Rock Lakes National Wildlife Refuge in the Montana Centennial Valley. So with protection there and in the adjacent Yellowstone National Park, what is known as the tri-state subpopulation of southwestern Montana, east-central Idaho, and northwestern Wyoming increased to about 640 birds by the late 1950s. And then the state of Minnesota got involved in the mid-1960s, and we followed in the mid-1980s.
And you were at the center of this effort, as I understand it. How did we go about bringing back trumpeter swans in Wisconsin?
Well, we looked at a variety of techniques. We started off in 1987 and 1988, while waiting in line behind Minnesota to go to Alaska to collect trumpeter swan eggs, because there were no trumpeter swans in the wild back then. The only folks that had trumpeter swans were game farms. So in 1987 and 1988, we utilized a technique called cross-fostering as a reintroduction technique, using mute swans as foster parents, mainly at a marsh site in southeastern Wisconsin. Well, we used 35 trumpeter swan eggs from avicultural sources, but we experienced very poor hatching success and survival, with only two cygnets or young swans reaching fledging age. So that technique was discontinued after the 1988 season and replaced by an innovative technique called decoy rearing, which was developed by the University of Wisconsin's Department of Wildlife Ecology in partnership with the DNR.
Right, so what is decoy rearing?
So decoy rearing involves imprinting cygnets on a life-size trumpeter swan decoy immediately after hatching, and then transporting the cygnets when they're about 3 to 5 days of age to sites at that time in northern Wisconsin, where they then followed floating decoys manipulated by University of Wisconsin interns in camouflaged float tube blinds. Hmm. So that was the decoy ring technique.
Wow.
The other main technique that we employed was called captive rearing, where cygnets were raised in captivity until 2 years of age. Their flight feathers were trimmed and the birds released at selected wetland sites in north central and northwestern Wisconsin. And those two basically formed the basis for our restoration effort, which began in full in 1989 when we flew to Alaska to collect trumpeter swan eggs for transport back to the Milwaukee County Zoo, where all of the collected Alaskan eggs were incubated during 1989 through 1997. A third, much less important technique, but still part of our program, was something called captive parent rearing. And that basically allowed cooperators to hold private pairs whose young, when they were produced, were released as yearlings. So those three techniques, but mainly decoy rearing and captive rearing, comprised the basis for the recovery effort.
Right, and so this has all been astonishingly successful. And for Wisconsinites who may not have seen a trumpeter swan and you know, except for the fact that they were struggling as a population, as a species in Wisconsin, wonder, you know, why they're so cool. These are kind of magnificent birds, aren't they?
They really are spectacular birds. They have a wingspan of more than 7 feet, and they stand about 4 feet high. They in fact, are the largest native waterfowl species in North America. So they are just a fantastic sight. To hear them and to see them flying, imagining a very large bird with a wingspan of more than 7 feet, and just a beautiful trumpet-like call. They really are a graceful and beautiful symbol of our wetlands.
And the name trumpeter swan, it comes from the call that they make, right?
Correct.
Does it sound like a trumpet?
It does. It does sound like a trumpet. And it's quite something to hear them. If you hear them before you see them, especially on a foggy spring or fall morning, and then you see them coming through the mist, it's a dramatic and spectacular sight, one that you will never forget.
We're talking with Sumner Madison right now about trumpeter swan recovery in Wisconsin. And going back to those initial trips to get trumpeter swan eggs in Alaska, you were on those trips. What was that like for you?
It was very interesting because I had an inner ear problem that I didn't know at the time. And so flying in a jet was fine, but getting up in a small bush plane was quite a challenge for me. That first year, I was collecting both for Wisconsin and the state of Michigan. We spent 13 hours collecting eggs. This is in the land of the midnight sun, near the Minto Flats in east central Alaska. And I was given conflicting advice as to whether I should have a large meal or a small meal. And I opted for the latter and unfortunately lost that within the first 20 minutes of
Oh, no.
At one point, the pilot biologist, Rod King, affectionately called Sky King, he turned to me and he said, "You're not going to expire on me, are you?" And that first year, I will never forget it. And I discovered then afterwards that I had this inner ear problem, and I had to take some medication to combat that. But the other thing that's important about that first year is that one of the eggs that I collected, that egg was hatched out at the Milwaukee County Zoo. That bird, as far as we know, is still alive, hatched out actually on my birthday on June 15th, and is going to be turning 27 years old. It's the oldest known banded trumpeter swan in North America.
And this is a swan known as 82K, isn't it?
That's correct, yeah.
Would you recognize her if you saw her?
She still has a collar. It's kind of worn, a little bit dilapidated, but I would recognize her by the collar.
So just briefly, Sumner, as we wrap up, going to be a new playbook for how to approach wildlife management?
Well, it's an interesting question. Probably the key lesson here is patience and persistence When we started in 1987 with cross-fostering, we experienced, as I mentioned, dismal success. Of 35 cross-fostered eggs, only two survived. Only two cygnets survived a fledging. So with a recovery goal of 20 breeding and migratory pairs by the year 2000, we were stuck at 17 to 18 nesting pairs in the late 1990s. Well, then in the year 2000, we had 44 nesting pairs, and ever since then, our trumper numbers have soared. So I remind my colleagues working with the whooping crane that, okay, they've experienced their share of setbacks these past 15 years, as we did our first 15 years. So I can say, okay, you've had your 15-year cross to bear. Now you'll begin to see success greeting you.
Oh, we hope they do. Sumner, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Sumner Madison is an avian biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and the trumpeter swan recovery effort has been so successful that the program has officially been retired. For now, trumpeters in Wisconsin are thriving.
Coming up after the news, we talk about celebrity and business boycotts of states that passed anti-LGBT religious liberty laws. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. There's more Central Time coming up.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, schools in many communities today are racially segregated. A guest says we need to learn what went wrong with busing in the past to desegregate schools today.
First, we're going to look south to states like North Carolina, Georgia, and Mississippi. Over the last few months, those states have come into the spotlight, especially as high-profile businesses and celebrities have boycotted or threatened to boycott them.
That's because they've all considered or passed what some call religious liberty laws, basically legislation that gives legal protections to businesses and faith-based organizations that refuse services to members of the LGBT community.
Opponents say the laws essentially make discriminating against gays and lesbians legal. Members of the business community have put pressure on states that have considered these laws after companies like Disney and Marvel threatened to stop filming in Georgia, and the NFL warned that Atlanta's bid as a site for the Super Bowl would be at risk. The Georgia governor announced that the bill would be vetoed.
More recently, celebrities like Bruce Springsteen and the band Pearl Jam have canceled shows in North Carolina to protest the religious liberty bill signed into law there.
Joining us now is David Graham. He's been following this issue. He covers U.S. politics and global news for The Atlantic. He's based out of North Carolina. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to first look at these laws, and let's look at the one in North Carolina in particular. It's a little different than some of the other laws that have been under this religious liberty label. Can you sum up the story there for us?
Sure. So the law in North Carolina was passed by the state legislature really in response to a city ordinance in Charlotte. And Charlotte passed this ordinance that was going to require schools and businesses to make transgender bathroom accommodations, and it also prohibited discrimination against LGBT people. And so then the state legislature called a special session and came in, and they passed this law in a day. And what it does is it prevents cities from passing those sorts of laws or ordinances. It prevents them from raising local minimum wages also, and it avoids the transgender, it voids the transgender bathroom accommodations. So basically overturning the law in Charlotte and then also applying that to the rest of the state as well.
And then the other kind of law that's gotten a lot of attention and this kind of boycott or corporate pressure is what we've come to call the religious liberty type of law, effectively saying, hey, businesses, you won't be punished for discriminating against people based on your religious objections. Is that right?
Right, exactly. And these are the cases. What you hear most often is the examples of, say, a cake baker or a wedding photographer who doesn't want to provide a cake or take photos at a same-sex marriage.
And let's get into this boycott issue now. North Carolina, more than in other states, it seems like, has really been the subject of this. Why do you think North Carolina's got such attention?
I think that the bill has grabbed people for a couple of reasons. One is that it's a little bit different from some of these other religious freedom laws, like the one in Mississippi or like the one that was rejected in Georgia. We've seen those before when a similar law came up in Indiana last year. There were big veto threats or big boycott threats, rather. So you've gotten some of that, but this one is a little bit different, partly because it also it bans these LGBT non-discrimination ordinances of all sorts. And I think that people see this as overreach, and they're trying to push back on it.
Well, talk us through first the entertainers. Who has said they're not going to play North Carolina?
You name it. I guess the biggest name is Bruce Springsteen, who canceled a concert in Greensboro a couple weeks ago. Ringo Starr announced he won't be playing a concert in Raleigh. Pearl Jam just canceled the show. Ani DeFranco, and those are the biggest names that I can remember, although there have been so many that it's hard to keep track of all of them. The other interesting thing is you have some artists who are consciously saying they will play North Carolina and will speak out. So Joel McHale, the comedian, played a show in Durham and donated all the proceeds to the local LGBT center. Or the band Against Me, which has a transgender lead singer, also announced they would be playing their show, and the lead singer said that she thought it was important that transgender artists show that they were not afraid and they would not stay away from the state.
As I understand it, some North Carolina activists who don't like this new law are also saying, hey, no, don't boycott us. Come here and draw attention to this issue. What have you been hearing there?
Yeah, exactly. And there's a real split in the state. If you look at the polling, it's pretty close to even, and there haven't been that many polls so far. But what you get across the state is really fairly progressive urban centers and then much more conservative rural areas. And so the people in these urban centers are saying, you know, listen, we agree with you and we oppose the law, and we really think it's important that these artists come here and speak out. There was a column in the New York Times by a bookstore owner in Asheville, which is a fairly progressive city out in the west of the state. And, you know, what she was saying was, when we understand why authors want to cancel readings and events in the state, but if you aren't coming to a place like our bookstore in Asheville that, you know, supports progressive causes, you're really hurting us more than you're hurting the Republicans who run the state government, and that's really not helping things very much.
Has there been reaction from supporters of this new legislation to these entertainer boycotts?
Oh, absolutely. It's been pretty negative, I would say. I think my favorite reaction was a U.S. rep who's a Republican said, if Bruce Springsteen wasn't going to play in the state, he would go see the artists who were, and Justin Bieber is coming this spring. And he said, you know, if Bieber is the person who's coming, I'll go to the Bieber concert.
Might be a different show, The Boss versus the Beeb.
A little bit.
We're talking about religious liberty laws, North Carolina's new law overriding local anti-discrimination efforts, especially as they pertain to lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender residents of the state, and in particular, boycotts surrounding them from entertainers and efforts from businesses, too. David Graham is with us from The Atlantic. He's been covering this. He's based in North Carolina, the center of this story right now. David, let's get to the business pressure. A lot of reaction after this law was passed. Direct pocketbook impact there in North Carolina.
That's right. And it's an interesting range of businesses. One, you've got some big businesses that are based in the state that have spoken out. Bank of America, I think, might be the most prominent one. And then you have other businesses that do business here and that are saying either they're reconsidering that or they won't go forward with expansions or they'll reconsider future plans. Deutsche Bank canceled an expansion. PayPal announced that it would not create a new center that was going to add 400 jobs in Charlotte. You've had also prominently the NBA said it was very concerned about the law ahead of the NBA All-Star Game for 2017, which is scheduled for Charlotte. The NCAA, which tends to hold pieces of its basketball tournament here, said it was reconsidering. And so you've got a wide range of businesses that have spoken out.
I'm going to look at that PayPal case because they were planning an opening thing in Charlotte, which is the city that had passed these protections, and their law was their ordinance was overridden by the state government. So in a way, they're getting their law changed and they're getting punished for what the state did, it sounds like.
That's very much the sense among people in Charlotte that they are caught in the middle of this sort of thing, and they feel like the people who run the state don't understand the impact that it is on Charlotte. I spoke to the Charlotte mayor a couple weeks ago, and she said one thing that she feels like she needs to do is to communicate to state lawmakers that although these, you know, those jobs may affect Charlotte directly, it's money into state coffers in the form of sales taxes and many other things, and that they need to understand that they're hurting not just Charlotte, but other places. You know, what's weird about this is that Charlotte has a reputation within the state in some circles as being, you know, not really of the state, a little bit too cosmopolitan, a little bit uppity, and not mixing in and too progressive. And so I think in some ways that makes it easier for lawmakers to smack it down with this law. And it also means that some people are less willing to speak up when Charlotte bears the brunt of boycotts like this.
In Indiana, we saw modifications to the religious liberty law after pressure from the NCAA. They've got a lot to say about Indiana there, the tourist industry. Georgia, we mentioned, the governor vetoed a religious liberty law there after threatened no more filming from Disney, maybe no Super Bowl for Atlanta. Is there any sign that these entertainer boycotts or these business changes of plans are affecting, you know, the people who actually vote on this legislation in the state legislature?
It's unclear how much it is. I think it's definitely making a splash. The local news is just dominated by stories about what businesses are saying what and the economic impact and speculating on the economic impact and talking about these artist boycotts. The question is at what point that's enough to push the state to reverse. And some, you know, I think one thing that's interesting about this is, in contrast to the Georgia law, which was pushed in a fairly deliberate process, and Governor Deal had a while to think about it, in which time Disney and others put some pressure on him to veto the bill. The North Carolina law was passed in a day. The legislative language was introduced after 10 o'clock one morning, and by 9 o'clock that night, the law was signed in, which meant there was no real time for that backlash to build ahead of time. Now it's happening after the fact, and I think that means it's a little bit slower process. But if the economy continues to suffer, I think it will definitely get people's attention. The other thing about that is North Carolina has really pushed to sort of establish itself as an alternative tech hub to places like Silicon Valley or Austin. This is the sort of thing that really drives tech companies away, and as more of those companies say they won't expand here or won't place jobs here, it makes it harder for the state to sort of maintain that reputation and build it.
Talking to David Graham, who covers U.S. politics and global news for The Atlantic, looking at boycotts, corporations deciding not to expand facilities, open new facilities in states like Mississippi and North Carolina based on things like religious liberty laws and overriding anti-discrimination laws in local governments.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think requiring faith-based organizations and businesses to serve members of the LGBT community infringes on religious freedoms? And what about these boycotts? Do you support the businesses and performers who are putting pressure on state governments, or are they hurting the people they're looking to help? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our conversation now with David Graham, who covers politics and global news for The Atlantic. And we're talking about boycotts of states that have passed laws letting faith-based organizations and businesses refuse service to gays and lesbians.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Should celebrities, bands like Bruce Springsteen, Pearl Jam, be boycotting, refusing to play in states that have passed religious liberty laws or, like North Carolina, overriding local anti-discrimination ordinances? Call in now, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Should high-profile businesses be putting pressure on state governments? So we've seen groups like NFL, PayPal, Disney threatening to pull business activity from various states after these laws are passed. And also local governments, state governments around the country, canceling all non-essential travel to some of these states. Call now, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. David, before we go to our callers, this is an interesting new world, an interesting new realm for businesses taking this kind of public stance on these issues that I think in the past, not too distant past, would have been viewed as way too controversial to weigh in on.
That's right. I think it's really, it's been sort of breathtaking to see how quickly businesses have become a major force in these fights over LGBT rights. And, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that many of them have LGBT employees and they feel like it's important to defend them. And so you've seen across the country that just big companies are the a major force, really bigger, I suspect, than what any musician can do. It just gets the attention of policymakers to see these economic forces throwing their weight around.
We'll get to our callers now. We'll start with Sean in La Crosse. Sean, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I generally favor LGBTQ rights, but one scenario kind of, I think, bothers me to some degree, and that is in the event that you have a small, closely held business, let's say a bakery owned by mom and pop, let's say, and mom and pop both have closely held religious beliefs about homosexuality and what the Bible tells them about that. And you have a homosexual couple wanting a wedding cake. What, I guess, is the alternative for the bakery owners? Would they have to either make that wedding cake or be sued in the submission? Now, I'm aware of the Hobby Lobby case, of the Supreme Court case that talked about the fact that closely held corporations such as Hobby Lobby can discriminate for religious reasons. I don't know if that would protect these smaller businesses or whether we're saying, you know, look, mom and pop, get out of the bakery business.
Sean, thanks for the call. And David, he's getting to a lot of issues that people are bringing up in this discussion. And first, let's talk about that, you know, that bakery example. That's actually one that has been an example. Is that the kind of argument we're hearing in a lot of states about the need for people making the case for religious liberty laws?
Right. That's exactly the case. Is you've got these cases, and I think, you know, we see these laws coming up really in the wake of the Supreme Court striking down any law that banned gay marriage. So suddenly you see states saying, well, now we have people who oppose gay marriage and don't really want to be, you know, supporting it, who feel like they're being dragged into it, and they need some sort of insulation in the form of laws that basically allow them to opt out of those kind of cases. The folks on the other side say, you can't just deny service to people. If you're in business, you're in business. You can't deny service to a black person because for whatever reason, and so you shouldn't be able to, you know, deny it to a gay person either. The question of what's a sincere religious belief and how that applies is, you know, very much still on the legal table, and there's a variety of different cases going on.
Sean also brought up the Hobby Lobby case, and that was related to the Affordable Care Act and whether a company could be required to provide contraception if, as he said, it's a family business or closely held business and it's against their religious beliefs. Is that something that's melding into this argument at all, David?
It's certainly something that's voiced. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't want to speak in a way that anyone would take
sure.
My advice in court. I do think one key difference there is the Hobby Lobby case concerns what companies have to provide to their employees in terms of birth control and other things, whereas this is a case of what services a business has to provide to the general public.
Sean, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to David Graham at The Atlantic about boycotts of states that have passed various types of laws, religious liberty laws, protections for businesses that don't want to do business with lesbians, gays, transgender people based on their religious beliefs. Also, the North Carolina law overriding local anti-LGBT discrimination ordinances. 800-642-1234 is a number. Doreen is with us next in Saukville. Doreen, hi.
Yeah, hi, guys. I stand with the states. I think they should stand strong for God. This is all about God, and I think all Christians out there should stand strong and stick up for their beliefs, because the devil's out there, and a lot of people just want to take God. Our country was formed on God.
Doreen, thanks for that call. And David, is this similar to what you're hearing in North Carolina?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways the North Carolina legislators who backed this law have framed in a slightly more specific way, which is that these transgender rules are really appalling and that they don't want men in women's restrooms, basically. I think that's maybe a little bit of a simplification of the cases in question. But often, yeah, that's the question that they bring it down to, is this is simple morality and men shouldn't be in women's restrooms.
And yeah, the whole bathroom argument, the characterization of this as a bathroom bill, is that something that was really front and center in the debate over this, even though the particular law did things besides that?
I think it was. And, it looks to me like that may have been a strategic choice. If you look at support for LGBT non-discrimination rules, it tends to be very high. People have come around fairly quickly on gay rights and don't like those sorts of things. They're still much, they're tentative on transgender issues. They don't understand them as well. They don't know what the situation is. And so it's much easier, I think, to pass a transgender bill, even in a place like Houston, where this came up for a vote. Houston's a fairly liberal city, and yet when there was a vote, this transgender bathroom accommodation was defeated. Transgender advocates say that there's really a lot of education that needs to be done. People don't understand transgender issues, and as a result, laws like this are more likely to pass.
Dorian, thanks for your call. We'll go now to Kurt in Chippewa Falls. Kurt, hi.
Yeah, the whole argument of the Carolina legislature is based on a theory of religious liberty. How would those folks react, say, if there was a member of a Christian denomination that considers blood transfusion to be sinful and wrong, and if that person is working in an ambulance service or first responders, and they refuse to give blood transfusions to somebody who is injured in an accident on the basis of their religious liberty?
Kurt, thanks for the call. Are people making those analogies, David?
I have not heard that specific analogy. I do think that there's been a strong sort of Christian sense to the North Carolina legislature over the last few years. There was an anti-Sharia bill similar to ones we've seen in other places. There was even a brief and ill-fated effort to enshrine Christianity as the official religion of the state. And so that's a very important element to all these laws is the Christian morality underlying it.
Time for one more brief call with Susan and Shawno. Susan, hi.
Hi, I'm a pastor and just want to remind people that there are lots of Christians who are LGBT and also allies, and that we believe Jesus called us to called us to love those with whom we disagree.
Susan, thanks for the call. David, the faith communities in North Carolina, are they lining up on both sides of this issue?
They are, absolutely. And what you see is there are many very progressive congregations that have spoken very strongly against the law. And they're hanging pride flags. They've done really many things to speak out against it. So there is a split between different denominations and different churches across the state.
Before we wrap up, just briefly, David, a lot of national outcry. Is this seen, though, as a done deal in North Carolina, or is this still a hot topic for debate there?
It's very much a hot topic, and I think people are waiting to see how much more pressure comes and whether and when it's enough for legislators to decide that they need to either repeal the law or amend it in some way that will satisfy and mollify its critics and maintain both the moral dimensions that people care so much about and also avoid discrimination.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's David Graham. He covers U.S. politics and global news for The Atlantic. He's based in North Carolina. He talked to us about recent boycotts from entertainers, some companies of states like North Carolina that have passed laws allowing faith-based organizations and businesses to refuse service to the LGBT community, or like North Carolina, override local anti-discrimination laws in states like North Carolina. You know what they say, old rockers never die, they just go on tour with AC/DC.
That's right. If you thought the era of hair metal was over, you can guess again. The band AC/DC just announced it's picking up Axl Rose from 80s band Guns N' Roses for its next tour. That tour is going to be called Rock or Bust.
Axl is taking over for AC/DC lead singer Brian Johnson, whose doctor told him he had to quit touring now or risk total hearing loss. He says it was a really tough decision, but probably, I think, the right call to make.
And after that tour, Axl Rose is going to be hitting the road again to go on tour with Slash and Duff McKagan in Europe, that time with his own band, Guns N' Roses.
Yeah, so a lot of 70s and 80s coming back here. I mean, AC/DC had one of the top three all-time selling albums in the world ever. A while back, I learned that when we looked up Thriller. It was like number two or number
three. Was this Back in Black?
Back in Black, yeah. And of course, Guns N' Roses, you were a huge fan.
I was a fan.
Huge,
I would say huge
loved
goes
them.
A little far.
Posters
yeah.
on the wall.
Well, I know you've modeled your own look after Axl.
After
so
Axl,
we have that in common.
And my rock and roll attitude. Well, let's wrap it up with giving a listen to the voice that will now front not only Guns N' Roses, but AC/DC. This is Central Time.